Thank you. It's super nice to be here in Berlin, in this building, but more specifically in this room. Until recently, I mean, this entire room is organized to face white painting with a black frame, and now maybe you imagine that an image has been projected onto that painting. So if we speak about the kind of canonic narratives, I'm very interested in the physical narrative that you are sitting inside, which is basically to the default setting. Let's say we are in the epicenter of this building, the place where anything that is placed on exhibition will be discussed. So the kind of thinking, the kind of brain of the oyster, produced maybe by the kind of endless friction. But what we all agree upon is that before the image went onto the white screen, there was no image there. So you didn't think of it as actually a white square or a rectangle with a black frame, despite the fact that there's quite a strong choreography of whites in this room, leading of different whites, which lead to that performance. So this is quite a complex agreement that we have negotiated to treat a particular colored surface as not a colored surface and even not as a surface. So I would like to talk a little bit about that. And of course, I was really struck by the very beautiful quote of Foucault, the introduction to his very first book in 1961. So it's such a romantic point, the preface to the first book. And of course, in this beautiful quote that you quote, he refers to the space that we occupy after forgetting who we have excluded as a white space. And he speaks then of the originary thickness in which culture takes shape. So this space is a kind of a thickness. You see that in order for Foucault to explain his concept of a kind of forgetting of limits, which is what gives the power to the limit, he invokes a kind of architectural image. So somehow architecture will be here the image of forgetting. So already he goes against a normal understanding of architecture as kind of the opposite of forgetting. So why would this be the case, and why so fascinating? Because of course, in the moment, the spaces of it's not simply the exclusion of the construction of madness as a category; it is the confinement of those that are mad. So the exclusion is not simply the removal of those that you forget, but the engine of the forgetting are the spaces of the clinic, of the asylum, of the hospital ward, of the prison cell, all of which were actually white spaces. I mean, and this is the interesting thing, that his image for the space that is created by confining, by the great confinement, his image of what we are left with is actually the same as the image of what it is that we will confine people in. So implied in Foucault's argument is a kind of logic of self-confinement, that we place ourselves in the asylum of the sane by confining the insane. And of course, the gesture of confining the other was always understood as an act of hygiene, of removing the kind of contamination. And the reason that the spaces of the clinic and the prison cell, the hospital ward, were white was, of course, hygiene. Hygiene was an enormous issue in the 18th century. Whitewash was being established in medical, prison, and military codes, and argued and debated, and hospital wards, prison cells, and military barracks were much discussed whether they were being whitewashed or not. So again, to repeat the point, the white space is not simply produced by forgotten acts of exclusion and confinement, but it is also, it's sort of a gesture of self-institutionalization or self confinement. So I use this as an excuse to talk a little bit about the history of the white space itself, the history of the image that he is using as a space of self-confinement, or more precisely here in this building. What of the more recent history of the white gallery, which of course is a kind of hygiene of the gaze, a kind of optical hygiene. Firstly, the gallery is, of course, a reduction of all senses down to vision, and then within vision down to an incredibly narrow range. How is it that we could all agree to synchronize ourselves, to forget almost every sense in order to, as it were, focus on an incredibly narrow bandwidth? And why would we agree? Not only how did we agree, but why would we do so? Of course, the white gallery, the white wall of the gallery is a limit, a wall precisely. But when I say a wall precisely, just because I teach in an architecture school doesn't mean I know more about walls than you do. In fact, a very good working definition of an architect is simply somebody that doesn't know what a building is. Everybody else knows and uses them. But for architects, buildings are sources of enormous mystery. And this is not rocket science. I mean, a painter is maybe somebody who doesn't know what a painting is, so paints their whole life in order to understand why they love that thing, which they don't know. And you use the word love exactly for that thing that you want to be close to but don't know what it is, right? So an architect would be somebody who loves architecture, which means they don't know what it is. They spend their life trying to understand what it is. And the one thing that you can be sure an architect doesn't know is what a wall is. In fact, if an architect knew what a wall is, an architect would never have made that huge mistake to decide to become an architect. That is to say, to be an unpaid philosopher of the wall. Now, philosophers, by the way, if they think about walls, they are accorded considerable money for that. Foucault becomes a little bit a philosopher by using architecture as the prop for his argument. Right. So, returning to the wall, don't for a minute think that I will offer you some sort of Zen insights into the wall. In fact, the white wall might be the last wall that about which one could be very clear. This limit, this white wall, is a wall, obviously, but paradoxically, it is precisely that wall which is seen to be without limit. No limit to what it could expose, and no limit to where it could be placed. And actually, it might be that the ability to place the white wall anywhere, in any time, is more radical than the possibility of presenting anything in front of that wall. Or to say it more again a little bit more precisely, what special kind of confinement is produced by a space or a way of looking that thinks of itself as being without limit? Like, what is the unique prison constructed by the thought that you are in a limitless space with a limitless capacity to observe? One possible argument is, of course, to say that the extraordinary expansion of the category of what constitutes the kind of appreciation of art and the spaces for art owes something, or is in fact the kind of testing of the hypothesis of Duchamp, of the ready-made, of course, that art would be that which would be signed by an artist or by a curator or the entire system of art. In other words, there is no limit to art, not even the possibility of defining it. In fact, Duchamp is very clear that the ready-made itself defies definition. He says that he denies the possibility of defining art and denies the possibility of defining this lack of definition of the ready-made. But one thing is for sure, that the Duchampian logic is a logic which would, as it were, call on an endless expansion of what constitutes art. In fact, the experience of art would be the experience of the expanding of the accepted objects for gaze. That is to say, the principle here is not the concept of expanding what could be seen as art, but the concept of art as expansion itself, as a form of expansion. And if this is the case, if art is expansion, then of course by definition the apparatus which validates what constitutes art will be in a state of ever expanding a kind of exponential expansion. The last thing we should ever be surprised at is the kind of continual kind of expansion of the massive, absolutely massive infrastructure that constitutes art in a moment in time in which arguably the entire planet is now covered with a kind of crust of art. There's not a single point on this planet where there isn't an artist making a video at this very moment. Actually, this is the place those videos are most likely to be seen, where the world would come to be, as it were, acknowledged. This very museum is sort of like a customs house. Like this, you get the stamp, yes, the world, you know, and then you go back out. Of course, what I'm not implying here is that somehow Duchamp theorized art in this extraordinarily influential way. In fact, I think Duchamp absolutely not an influential figure. His arguments of 1913 to 17 are only really starting to be understood and recognized in the 40s and 50s. And anyway, I would argue that they are not inventions. Precisely the concept of the ready-made is itself, in a certain sense, a ready-made in the sense that what he does is demonstrate how the system works, not change the system. Nevertheless, I think that what it is that he demonstrates has a very important relationship to the global expansion of the white wall, which it's important to note, despite this image in which you see him sitting with one of the early ready-mades in front of a white wall. In fact, the white wall comes somewhat later than this argument. I guess what I'm trying to argue is that what he demonstrates is in parallel to a kind of a history of the expansion of the white wall, and there's a relationship between those two things, but one is not the theory versus the other as a practice. What is this ever-expanding white wall? Well, it's a painting. Maybe it's one painting. Certainly it's the largest painting in the world. It's a painting that's whose scale now matches that of the world. It's a kind of an enormous monochrome whose presence is simultaneously forgotten and then seen, forgotten and seen. So it's a kind of a flickering painting. So ubiquitous is this painting that it doesn't even have to be there now. You can make the entire argument without even the white white being present, which perhaps is the final confirmation of its canonic force. The full force of the law operates without the presence of the figure of the law, that is to say, in this case, the white wall. The white wall is fully the white wall when it doesn't need to be there to be there, and this is what I would argue. Now, the history of the white wall of the gallery, if one were to tell this story, and I can only sketch a few kind of highlights of a possible story about it, goes directly to the kind of conceptual and historical intersection of art and architecture. In particular, it goes to stucco. And stucco is neither structural nor ornamental. It is exactly the interface between structure and image. More recently, or there's quite a long history of thinking of it as support. If we want to think about the history of the white wall, we would have to think about arguments made in the 15th and 16th century, particularly around paper and the idea of the blankness of paper becoming, as it were, a visible proof of the independent thoughts of an artist. That is to say, a space in which the brain of an artist would leave a trace or a mark. This coincides, not by accident, with a movement of the technique of using white on wood to produce an image to also placing white on canvas so that that image would become mobile. So there is understood to be a gesture that precedes the image, which is the construction of a white surface. This white surface used to be part of the building and then becomes, as it were, a piece of the building is able to be mobilized, and one could argue that the whole discourse around the art mark and so on is liberated by this technique of the white. The white is not simply a space in which the artwork will appear and be exhibiting. It is the precondition of such an image in the first place of support. Most famously, Gottfried Semper, the architect, gets into a huge fight with the early phases of the discipline of art history. His enemies are determined that ancient art is white, And it is the whiteness of the white marble is the sort of basis of art. Of course, it was Semper's kind of criminal response that no, in fact, architecture is constructed by the coloured paint which is applied to the stucco, which is the real physical support for architecture, and white marble was only used because it was such an amazingly good surface to paint on. And this argument, very systematically made, in which his enemy, particularly Franz Kugler, loses every single fight, and Kugler's reward for losing the fight was to become the very first professor of art history as such in a university. That is to say, one could argue that the very foundation of art history as a discipline is based on not acknowledging the foolishness of the argument about the white. So ingrained is the white, not just as a surface then of in which you would agree to experience an image as an image, but even as a kind of support for the discipline that will be your guide in such an experience. But just again, returning to Semper, he's arguing that every single surface of ancient buildings is covered with white stucco, and that white stucco is then simply acting as a surface for receiving the coloured paint, which is the representative of the original fabrics with which we created ourselves as a thoughtful animal. What's of course striking in the 20th century is that both for the white underneath the painting on the canvas actually goes from being the support for the image to the image itself, but also for the architecture, the white underneath the stucco itself becomes the very basis of the architecture. So somehow at the intersection between art and painting is liberated the possibility of a white space for receiving art and of a white building. Of course, it's possible to argue that the white gallery is neither painting nor architecture, but is exactly the kind of consequence of the dissolving of the frame, which at some point took over the responsibility of defining the difference between the painting and the architecture. So it actually, again, you wouldn't ask architects necessarily what is a white gallery, because precisely maybe what it is not is architecture. But to tell this story, it would be a story of a series of overlapping trajectories. This required a kind of evolution both in the emerging disciplines of architecture and in the kind of quasi-disciplines of art. White paint basically moved from the wall to the painting and from the painting to the wall and vice versa, backwards and forwards, like the lapping of the tides. It goes backwards and forwards, dissolving the frame over a period of time to incubate the white gallery. And it's a very, very slow kind of ecological shift. But, and there is a backwards and forwards within the world of art, if we can define such a thing, and within the world of architecture, with many different whites. So there's a lot of kind of painting going on, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. Suspended between architecture and art, neither building nor painting, the frame, the limit, defining the difference, or actually allowing one to consider something to be art, dissolves into the space of white in this very slow arrival, a kind of flickering between statement and non-statement. The white wall comes very, very slowly and a very long time after Duchamp is making the arguments which are perfectly consistent with its rise. Where support becomes statement, even shocking statement, then becomes support again. In other words, it is obscured again, and then again and again and again. So this will be the single... I'm going to apologize in advance for an almost criminal act, which is kind of the history of the White Gallery in 30 seconds. So I would ask you not to pay attention. But here are some quick points. Of course, Semper is enormously influential on Otto Wagner, who's translating these arguments into the kind of rise of industrialized society, most obviously represented by the subway lines, which you see in the foreground, which are being constructed by Otto Wagner, with the stations being decorated by Olbrecht, who is making the Secession Building here as a kind of white building, but also arguably as the first kind of contemporary space of art. As you can see from the section, it's a completely industrialized space. It's a kind of a warehouse with light coming from above, enabling almost anything to be displayed on the inside. So it's again related to the idea of a building without a simple distinction between inside and outside is the beginning of a kind of possible limitless space. This is the main technology, the even light that will come from above, not from the side, that will enable each and every exhibition to be a new architecture installed, including famously the Macintosh's white room installed in 1900, which was shocking in its simplicity and austerity. These images, which will appear to you as decorated, are images of a kind of a shocking arrival of a simple whiteness. It was enormously inspirational. Of course, it was coming directly out of Margaret and Charles' apartment. Some of the details are coming out. What's crucial about these interiors are, in a sense, the way in which architecture now is only the most minor shift in the quality of the empty white page. And even the sense in which the white is not a sort of, as it were, a white support in the background for some kind of a figure. The figure itself is, as it were, almost, as in the tradition of stucco, kind of molded out of the white. Or to see it the other way around, the white surface is actually coming out of ornament. So white is not arriving as a rejection of ornament. White is arriving as the appropriate ornament for an industrialized society. It's kind of, as it were, being manufactured by this ornament. This wardrobe, which became very famous when it was published in Berlin and very influential, is a diagram not of ornament placed on white, but of white, as it were, sliding out of the ornament. A series of all-white rooms are done in the sense. Again, I hope it's clear from the images that one is, as it were, living inside the thickness of the white, to use Foucault's term, whether it be here in the Project for an Art Collector or here in the Hill House. This will enable Hoffman and Moser to do this interior inside the Secession building. So this is a building which has a white exterior, but any possible interior. Now we get something like the white gallery. Literally, it's a gallery constructed 1903 inside, and of course Hoffman will do his own all white outside and inside building with the sanatorium in 1904. The kind of enemy of that gang is operating with the same language at the same time. Adolf Loos does this cafe using white stucco on the outside and the inside, one block away from the Secession building, as his critique of that building. And of course, in 1910, this is before the flowers were added to the facade to try to domesticate it. This was the radical facade of the building in stucco, or the equally stucco from the same year, Villa Steiner. At this point, there is a confusion. Loos is misunderstood. He's understood as the enemy of ornament. He's a very faithful representative of Gottfried Semper's view. The white here is the ornament appropriate for our times. So this is an image, precisely, a decorative image. And Le Corbusier himself, trained as a decorative artist, very, very knowledgeable about the situation in Vienna, offered a job by Hoffman, is thinking and digesting all of these arguments and producing what would be thought of as a kind of canonic image of modern architecture, here with the all-white model of the Citroën house exhibited in 2021. Somebody who went to the exhibition asked for a house, so this house is produced, the one and only all-white house of Le Corbusier in Vaucresson, finished in 1923, again with the kind of interior. So just to say, we can very quickly get into the production of white spaces that may look to you like galleries. In fact, when Le Corbusier himself does his very next building, which will be a kind of a gallery, the walls on which the paintings will not be white. Right? Here, the object to be exhibited is the inhabitant. Le Corbusier speaks of the law of Rieperlin. It will be the law, a police action by which everything, it will be unlimited in the sense that everything, the modernity of everything will be revealed. Of course, the parallel figure to quickly bounce equally criminally through at high speed is Malevich in an independent parallel track. Painting is being undone, of course, famously 1915 with the black square, which even in its current condition you can see that it's painted over one of his earlier futurist paintings, which had a little bit of white. So what's going on here is that the little bit of white around a futurist painting is giving way to the black square. But of course, he considers his greatest achievement to have been the white on white of 1918, and not just the not just this key work. He says that he has passed into the white beyond. Follow me, comrade aviators. Sail into the depths. And he repeatedly describes this as the description of the infinite. Notice, of course, that it's not simply a white painting. It's white on white. It's part of a series of what he calls the dissolution of form. Remember, of course, suprematism is about a sort of a zeroing of form. The non-objective art will only be accomplished when the white is even able to dissolve the white. So radical is this accomplishment that Malevich will stop painting and start to become an architect, right? And he starts with houses and so on and moves into the all-white architectons. In other words, mission is accomplished in the kind of George Bush sense, and he heads off in this zone. We, I think, lack the ability to understand the meaning of these works. This is how they might be experienced today as a kind of a sequence against what we would see of today as the kind of uber white wall. But it's very important to notice how kind of canny Malevich was about this. After having exhibited as his kind of finest work, the white on white at the bottom, in 1920, he ended with a single canvas that had a frame but was empty. The actual frame itself taking over the responsibility. In 1923, he exhibited another blank canvas, now with the name Suprematist Mirror. 1925, he concluded an exhibition with two empty canvases, again under the name Suprematist Mirror. So he repeatedly presented his work. As you probably know, Malevich, like most artists, was completely dishonest about the dating of his work. He worked incredibly hard to make it seem that the black square was done in 1913. He didn't get away with it, so it still sits at 1915. He's always doing his own kind of biographies, and these biographies culminate in the all-white paintings. This is the key point. He says, usually the public says, but the canvas is empty. This, by the way, is the white of the first version, of which there are many, as you know, the first version of the black square. So this is the white on the edges. He says, usually the public says, but the canvas is empty. What do you mean it's empty? When you can see that the canvas is painted with white paint. Actually, you can see his fingerprint and so on. Consequently, it's not empty, he says. If the white canvas was empty, there would not inspire any question or indignation. So a very, very careful reflection upon the fact that the white is not the absence of a statement, but is the ultimate statement, and it's a statement about the loss of limits, which, of course, is what leads him into a kind of cosmic project for architecture. And again, just very, very fast, to note the background behind these images. So this is coming from the last Futurist exhibition of 1915. You see that Tartlin exhibits two of his counter-reliefs, and Tartlin himself placed white paper in the corner where those reliefs were shown. You see this one and this one. But this is completely unlike what was happening where Malevich was presenting these works. So it's very, very important to sort of see the context in which the white on the black, or the black on the white, was being very presented. And if we go very fast, looking at the spaces in which Malevich's works were being exhibited, you can see that almost systematically they get lighter and lighter with time. So we go from there to when the white on whites were first exhibited, paintings of 1918 exhibited 1919 in Moscow, to Moscow again, another presentation, to Petrograd 1923, the white paintings are here surrounded by others. Leningrad, it gets lighter and lighter. Berlin 1927, then of course Essen. 1929. This is actually a kind of a very light beige from a kind of a monk's cloth. This is exactly the beige. This is exactly the color that Alfred Bauer saw when he was forming the Museum of Modern Art. So when the Museum of Modern Art opens 1929, it opens with this kind of a beige. The white of MoMA develops every year. By 1932, when the International Style Exhibition is held, you can see the difference between the white of Le Corbusier that we were referring to before and the white of the space of exhibition. Even in the Museum of Modern Art, which is, of course, trying to lead the way in that sense. Maybe you see it more clearly in this image. And of course, in the Cubism show of 1936, you see Malevich's white on white on the white of that time, and we are now with almost no distinction between the square of the white and the white itself. But only one could argue that only in 1939, when the Museum of Modern Art opens its new building with the Art in Our Time show, only then do you have the white that is, as it were, the canonic white. So if one can refer to a white gallery as a kind of canonic phenomenon, that is being established in 1939, but Museum of Modern Art is not imagining itself as being just one more museum. It imagines itself as a modernizing museum. That is to say, all museums must be inspired. So this is, as it were, as much of a statement as the Malevich's white on whites were 20 years earlier. This is meant to, as it were, shock you with its modernity. So if we really speak about the canonic force of the white gallery, we would have to wait until the 40s and 50s, and already by then, the whiteness is itself being exposed, most famously, of course, in 1957 by Yves Klein with his exhibition of The Void, and here he is pointing not to nothing, but what he describes as the enormous fullness of the gallery, which is reduced whenever you place an object in it. So he's arguing that art, as normally described, is an enormous reduction of the infinite capacity of the white surface, and as it were, systematically. Of course, this is not a white that was there before he painted it. This is a very special white that would look like a white that was there before he did it. This is like how to make a statement that you're not making a statement. I will actually make the ready-made as a ready-made. So, and of course, Duchamp very much in his mind, but maybe more interesting. But note, we're already in 57, and again, he slips a white monochrome into the sequence before he gives up entirely for the blue. 1961, the same year of Foucault's reference to the white space that would be produced by this forgetting, is, of course, the production of this void room in the house of Mies van der Rohe in Krefeld, and not by accident, he is being filmed making the white and telling us the exact chemical composition of this white. Located within this architecture, literally, there will be a label for the emptiness that is going to be produced with great effect to produce this room, a room so infinite that he could disappear into it and literally be, as it were, reborn out of it. And then in 1962, probably the ultimate work of all, which, of course, is to go into the Museum of Modern Art and literally remove paintings from the wall and then photograph the consequences alongside each other to produce this sense of emptiness. Staying with the 60s, 68, the most famous example here, of course, where you could argue that the above-ground section of Mises' building is a kind of vitrine within which the mechanism below ground, the default mechanism of what is by then a canonic presentation of art, will itself be exhibited as such, with the paintings not only there, but the white surfaces themselves hung as if they were paintings, revealing, as it were, the secret below. And maybe to finish with an example of Dan Graham exposing the gallery as a gallery in its whiteness and its emptiness and its infinity in 1976, which gets us back, of course, to the Museum of Modern Art and using a very clumsy professor's trick of having an African-American maintenance worker maintaining the color, the super canonic color of the ever bigger walls of the ever expanded Museum of Modern Art. So what are the key points in this criminally short story? The story is something like this, that the White Gallery, which has such extraordinary force of law, and that force evident by the lack of attention paid to it, the ease with which we cannot see it, is flickering between support statement, support statement, support statement. It is not even canonic before Klein and the others are exposing it in a kind of necessary next step from the kind of Duchampian argument. Almost as soon as it was established, the White Gallery itself was placed inside the world of art and exhibited as yet another artifact, as it were, as the ultimate demonstration of its power. But it's, of course, no longer necessary for something to be inside the gallery in order to be art. The logic of exhibition is now woven into every aspect of contemporary life. The idea of the gallery is now placed inside the world of art now being bigger probably than the world itself. We find the White Gallery floating there like any other painting as an ongoing work of art. The gallery is no longer, of course, isolated from the world. The hygiene is not the exclusion of the forgotten other. It's much more in the language or the logic of the self-confinement. In this world of white in which almost anything could happen, there are very few arrests, very few murders, very little blood, very little noise, actually, despite the fact that almost every museum in the world is determined to show that almost anything can happen in that museum. All the censors that were excluded, all the people that were excluded, all the politics that was excluded, there was a mission in the exhibition world to make sure that everything that hasn't been exhibited is now exhibited, but somehow in such a way that it is unbelievably safe. This white clinic to which we have assigned ourselves or checked ourselves towards remains a space in which almost anything can be seen, but with almost zero consequences. So it's a kind of a massive anesthetic ability to maximize our ability to see everything, but to remain as it were utterly disconnected from it, despite the fact that connection is no longer a spatial thing. The museum is much more in our cell phone than it is in the galleries to which we work. We, as it were, enter the gallery again to receive, as it were, some kind of check or some kind of approval on the logic that we will work. To summarize then, it's not simply a matter, if one was attempting to undo this logic, it wouldn't be a matter of listing the exclusions. In fact, the very system itself is in the business of listing the things that it has excluded in a kind of without even the trace of bad conscience or even good conscience, almost without conscience at all. Almost automatically, the logic requires the kind of return of everything into the gallery that has been kept out in order to protect the white wall itself. So all I'm saying in this very long-winded way is that the real problem is probably the idea of the unlimited, the thought of some kind of space without limits or some kind of potential of limits. Having said all of that, if any of this is true, I'm super happy to be self-confined in this particular gallery. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mark Wigley. Next speaker is Kerstin Starkemeyer, who, in my understanding, will present perhaps a dialectically flipped counter-canon or counter-narrative on two major construction sites of the canon 20th century, formalism and mimicry, of course, Nachahmung, mimesis, and mimicry as the ultimate sort of terrain of ambivalences and inversions. Kerstin Starkemeyer, a deboarded formalism on mimicry and its borders. Kerstin Starkemeyer is a professor at the Akademie der Bildenden Künste in Nuremberg, before in Munich, and with a background in both political science and art history. The shifting discords between both are central to her work. I'm just going to mention a few of her publications. Collected essays in Power of Materials, Politics of Materiality. I think one of the most interesting accounts of the kind of currency of new materialisms and the attempt to reconcile them with earlier critical languages. And two books co-authored with Marina Wischmidt. I apologize for the missing A here in the printed biography. A, Autonomy and Entgrenzter Formalismus, to be published by B-Books and Polypen Series in 2016. I'll cut it short. Welcome, Kerstin Starkemeyer.